We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. So, plenty to cover this week because we are starting.
We're to the end of the year.
We are.
And every year, this is actually the 20th year, God help us, for our year-end list of most, the stories of the year that didn't get enough media attention. And we're going to do local this week, and then we'll do national, international as we get to the year's end. So we'll start out with that. But we had some things happening this week, too, that we want to talk about.
Yes.
Mike, you okay over there?
Well, I'll just start. This week, the city council voted unanimously to give Uber and Lyft drivers the right to organize. This is the first time, excuse me, in the U.S. that any government has voted to allow contract workers, which is how Uber and Lyft drivers are treated, to form a union. And, of course, that's created a big stir nationwide because if it stands up in court and is determined that it's legal to allow it, then it could change the way not just many of these new sort of app-based businesses function, but the way a whole lot of tech businesses function all over the United States and perhaps other parts of the world as well. Now, it's been a long, dirty secret of big companies like Microsoft and Amazon and other tech companies that they hire a lot of contract workers and don't pay them benefits and don't withhold taxes for them and so forth. And this could change all that.
Yeah, and for rideshare businesses in particular Uber, but also Lyft and some of the other smaller companies, this is the first time there's been a major pushback because the venture capitalists behind Uber and Lyft have had the resources to literally go city to city and get all kinds of exemptions for regulatory issues that have applied to taxi companies and other companies that are competitors. This is the first time there's been pushback where they haven't really gotten their way on an issue like this. So that's a significant development as well. So on a number of counts, City Council did well for themselves this week.
Yeah, and it was amazing to see that it was a unanimous vote, too. There was really no one on the council who stood up and said, well, you know, let's give these big companies a break.
Yeah, and that's a sharp departure from a couple of years ago when it really was a major issue that taxi operators were saying were being screwed by these new competitors. And Uber and Lyft did, in fact, get all kinds of exemptions from city council. That's shifted over the past couple of years, and it makes you wonder why council members like Gene Godden and Tim Burgess and so forth have done a 180 on this, or whether they actually even really understand the new technology and these apps.
All right. Also this week, a challenge to the upzone in the U District.
Yeah, the Seattle Displacement Coalition has filed an appeal of the upzone in the U District, which would allow essentially skyscrapers to the buildings that are substantially larger than the Safeco Tower that is the highest building now in the U District. Those buildings would dominate the U District, the area west of the campus. Historically a lot of students have lived in a lot of lower income apartment buildings. Those buildings and old houses are all really being torn down for anybody who hasn't been in that neighborhood lately. And the upzone would create enormous density in that neighborhood, but would also create, as we've seen in other parts of the city, a lot of market rate housing that would cater to faculty members, that would cater to wealthy foreign students and their families and so forth, and really force out a lot of traditional students who used to be able to live somewhat close to campus. The appeal to that upzone having been filed on the basis that the city didn't even bother to do the legally required analysis of something called a displacement risk analysis, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the idea that people who now have affordable housing in the University District, are they going to be displaced? Are they going to have to move somewhere else or become homeless or whatever, start couch surfing, etc., because they can't afford what are now reasonably low rent rooms or apartments or studios in the U District. The city is supposed to look at that. The city is supposed to look at one-for-one replacement of those units in new developments that go in. And that historically has not been enforced at all, and they didn't even bother to look at it with the upzone for the U District. So we'll see once again with a new city council that's somewhat more progressive, we think, coming in January, whether that will be revisited.
Yeah, it's kind of like they're picking off the low-hanging fruit when it comes to changing zoning laws, because they figured, I'm sure, that in the university district there weren't a whole lot of permanent tenants there that would come to a city council meeting and complain.
And the University of Washington usually gets whatever it wants.
Whatever it wants, yeah. And also, currently, the university district is one of the few places in the city of Seattle where you can find reasonably priced rent still. So the fact that it's already got a certain heights in place that you don't have in other neighborhoods, and the fact that it's already got a lot of rental housing there already means that it was a very easy move for the city council, but it shouldn't have been.
All right. And then finally, moving on to jumping to international, and John Kerry trying to broker a deal.
Yeah, most of what we heard this week about Syria and about international affairs had to do with the Republican presidential debate on, I believe it was Tuesday night, and you know, the idea that that each of them was trying to out-tough the other. You had Donald Trump saying he was going to shut down the internet, and Chris Christie saying, well, you know, I'm gonna shoot down Russian planes and start World War III, to applause from the audience. Meanwhile, back in the real world, Secretary of State John Kerry, on behalf of the Obama administration, and his counterpart in Russia and Vladimir Putin in Russia, were in Moscow trying to negotiate a settlement to the Syrian conflict, and trying to set up an international conference, which was supposed to happen at the end of this week and may happen next week, to bring together all of the different players. There was a significant concession by the United States and Kerry in those negotiations. One of the major sticking points with Russia, which of course Syria has been a major patron of Russia for a number of years, and an important Mediterranean port that Russia can have access to. Russia has backed President Assad. The United States has been demanding, as a matter of policy, a regime change, even though we're on the ground. We're effectively defending the Assad government against ISIS and other Syrian rebels. And the official U.S. policy is to back moderate, quote-unquote moderate, rebels that don't in fact exist.
Yeah, when in fact the Syrian government has pretty much destroyed most of the moderate rebels, and the only really effective rebels that we can support against ISIS is the Nusra Front, which the U.S. considers a terrorist organization.
Yeah, so the U.S. Basically came around to Russia's side on this one, because Russia has been demanding that the future of Assad be settled by the Syrian people in any kind of a settlement of the Syrian civil war.
You would think that would be our position.
Yeah, and the U.S. has said, no, we want Assad out. So ironically, for all the old Cold Warriors out there, it's Russia that has been demanding democracy in Syria, and the United States, which has been saying we can't have elections because elections might have a result that we don't like. We saw that in Egypt, and we've seen that in Palestine and other countries.
We saw that in Iraq, right? Yeah. After the invasion of Iraq.
Very much so. So the U.S. has been a little skittish on that, but Kerry gave on that one and agreed to the Russian position that they could have elections rather than demanding as a precondition for talks that Assad be forced out. So while the U.S. and Russia are and the European Union and various people on the ground are inching toward having peace talks, you've still got the presidential process in this country talking primarily about how many civilians it's okay to bomb, as though that's going to solve anything. It's a real disconnect with what's actually happening on the ground.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, then we'll move to this year's most overhyped and underreported, or
Let's just go with the underreported and okay. With also an eye toward what to look for in 2016 as well, because there's a lot of overlap there.
Yeah. Right. At the top of my list was the sad saga of Bertha. For folks who are out-of-town listeners may not remember that Bertha is the huge drilling machine that is currently sitting in a big pit underneath the waterfront here in the city of Seattle, trying to dig the largest traffic tunnel ever dug in the United States. Bertha broke down. It's been a while now since Bertha's been able to move. And in May
about,
of...
About a year and a half, actually.
Yes, and in May of this year, WSDOT, the Washington Department of Transportation, announced that Bertha was damaged far more extensively than they expected. By August, Bertha was the focus of multiple lawsuits between the various groups that are digging the tunnel, the Seattle Tunnel Partners, which are the private contractors who are operating Bertha, the company that I believe it's Hitachi, the company that built Bertha, the insurance companies that will probably be on the hook for some of the damages, although they're suing to try to not have to pay, and the Washington State Department of Transportation, all in on the lawsuit frenzy. By October, Seattle Tunnel Partners said that Bertha wouldn't start moving again until December 23rd. Well, December 23rd is coming up here in just a few days, and they're currently having some problems getting Bertha started.
Nothing's happening.
Yeah, they're having a few issues with getting Bertha started, starting and testing the repairs, so it could be after Christmas or be after New Year's.
Yeah, and bear in mind that this tunnel was supposed to be open for traffic by the end of 2015, and that's not happening.
That's not happening, no.
And as you recall also several years ago, then-Mayor Mike McGinn took an awful lot of grief for talking about being concerned that the city of Seattle and Seattle taxpayers would be on the hook for cost overruns and was basically laughed at by other politicians and by local media. Well, that's still very much a going concern. We're going to have to follow that in 2016 very closely, because there's a lot of sentiment, particularly on the Republican Screw Seattle side of the state legislature, for sticking the city of Seattle with some or all of the cost overruns, and that's something we're still going to have to follow.
Yeah.
All right. Your next item.
Well, let's see. We have a whole cluster of items around transportation and real estate in Seattle. Once again, in 2015, we have real estate interests dominating Seattle politics, although the city council elections and the new district system worked very well in opening up the process. Rather than having automatic coronations of existing incumbents, four of the incumbents did not make it to the general election. Three decided to retire, and another, Gene Godden, did not make it through the primary. So we have a number of new people coming on to city council in 2016. One is already in because she's replacing somebody who, Sally Clark, who left earlier this year. So Lorena Gonzalez has already been sworn in. The others will be sworn in the first week of January. And we had something like almost four dozen or so people running in the primary, which is a huge number. Every single new district was contested by three or more candidates in the primary this year. And we had a number of grassroots campaigns, some of which were successful, some of which didn't make it, that had very strong showings in the general election, which is something we have not seen in past years. So it was something of a sea change in terms of who gets represented on city council and how easy it is for grassroots candidates that can't automatically raise a whole bunch of money to get on to city council. We also had the passage of I-122, which is going to create both greater transparency and a public funding mechanism for local elections in the future. So it'll be very exciting to see how that plays out in the next elections in 2017.
Okay. And then this year, too, we had a lot of fighting over the homeless and over housing affordability. These two issues are very closely linked. In January, the one-night count of homelessness showed a 21% increase in the homeless population in King County, a massive increase. But it really wasn't until November, almost the entire year had to pass, before the mayor actually declared a state of emergency when it came to the homeless population. Of course, then once he did that, the fighting began over funding.
Yeah, and there's also a new commission to replace the 6,840-year plan to end homelessness, which didn't quite work out in the first 10 years.
Of course, when the dust settled at City Council, there was some more money for homeless shelters, but not nearly the amount of money that some of the council members, particularly Shama Sawant and Nick Licata, would have liked to have seen, particularly going into this winter when the homeless are at particular risk for suffering from the cold weather. Now, there was also a lot of fighting over housing affordability. The housing affordability advisory group that the mayor had set up released its report, the HALA report, in which their central finding was that 65% of Seattle is zoned for single-family housing, which is making much of Seattle look like a suburb. Now, the HALA report recommended upzoning only about 3% of that single-family zoned housing, and yet that was so controversial that the mayor and the city council pretty quickly abandoned the idea of upzoning any of the single-family housing zoning in the city of Seattle. But I think just about everybody can see that that has to be done if we're going to increase densities. And eventually, hopefully, drive down the price of rental housing.
Yeah, that's clearly where it's going to go. The issue with this, of course, and the big elephant in the room is that all of the new development that's coming in is primarily market rate housing, and there is no real effective mechanism for ensuring that some of the new development is affordable, or that the existing stock of affordable housing, the rapidly dwindling existing stock of affordable housing, now, is being replaced.
The city council had passed a couple of ordinances that put a tax on developers, saying that, look, you either have to include a little bit of affordable housing in your development or pay a fee. But there are questions about, since most developers are opting to pay the fee, there are questions about whether that fee was actually high enough and whether the requirements for affordable units in developments was a high enough percentage as well, because clearly developers are opting not to build it.
Yeah, there's a couple different issues here. One of them is the affordable housing that's not being built, and the other is asking developers to pay portions of the cost of infrastructure the city has to put in, whether it's sewage or utilities or things like transportation or things like schools and parks, to accommodate the new population that's coming in and all these new developments. This is something that every other city in the region requires, but Seattle does not, and it's one of the ways in which the developers are getting massive corporate welfare from the city because they're not being asked to pay any of these costs, and they're not being asked to provide affordable housing. And the affordable housing rate that Maria was mentioning earlier is marginally higher than it has been in past years. City Council did get that through in 2015, but it's still nowhere near what is actually required for one-to-one replacement.
Yeah, and when the mayor announces at the end of the year that, oh, wow, developers have paid a lot of money into this fund, we can use the money paid in this year to build 800 new units of affordable housing, you have to look at that and go, wow, excuse me, but we can do better.
Yeah, and the 800 units that the mayor is talking about, two things there. Number one, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the need and the demand that's out there. And number two, the city's definition of affordable is itself very suspect.
Very
because
questionable.
It's much higher than what most people would consider affordable.
And whether those units stay affordable or not is something that the city hasn't pursued, since they don't audit buildings that say they have 15-20% affordable units. Those units often don't stay affordable for very long.
Yeah, the enforcement mechanisms for these things
just
really
don't
haven't
exist.
Been funded at all.
Yeah.
All right.
So while we're doing that, we did have once again all kinds of issues around transportation funding in the city of Seattle as well. It's not just BRTHA, but the fact that the transportation levy that was passed by voters in November, $930 million, roughly double what the previous transportation levy had been in the city of Seattle. But those projects that were listed and all those glossy flyers that were sent out to voters ahead of the general election aren't actually required. in the ordinance. They're not actually required as part of the levy. That's up to city council to determine how that money will be spent. And so as we moved into 2016, ensuring that what has happened with past transportation levies does not happen in the new levy, and the enormous backlog of, for instance, road and bridge repairs and other basic transportation expenses that have not been met in past years, while money instead gets diverted to the Mercer Mess or to the streetcar project that that Mayor McGinn championed, but instead actually goes to some of these repair projects and backlogs, that money actually is spent the way it was promised to voters.
Mm-hmm. And then this year, too, we saw some kind of not very well covered by the media news stories about continuing fighting over police reforms. The Community Police Commission did an end run this year around Mayor Murray and submitted their recommendations on police reform directly to the City Council. Now, the Community Commission...
And they did that because they were frozen out by,
yes,
by the mayor's office.
The Community Police Commission was created by the under the Memorandum of Agreement between the City of Seattle and the Department of Justice, that there had to be a body that would let community groups and civilians sit on it and make recommendations on changes to the police department as part of the reform process. The Community Police Commission had submitted their reforms to the mayor and was in negotiations with him for months, and those negotiations reached a stalemate, so the CPC went around the mayor and submitted them directly to the City Council, saying, maybe you'll take some action on some of these. Now, there were two key reforms that the mayor had particularly objected to. One was the question of who would get to hire and fire the head of the Office of Professional Accountability and the auditor who oversees the OPA, which is the internal group that looks at issues that arise when a citizen makes a complaint about officers using undue force. And there was a big disagreement over how many reforms have already been implemented and whether or not certain certain half steps should be counted as real reforms. The CPC's suggestions, of course, were very quickly dropped by the majority of the City Council, pretty much filed away and forgotten.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the city has been in negotiation with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, which is the union that represents rank and file officers, and which has been the chief impediment to a lot of reforms moving forward, because they are changes in the work conditions and therefore have to be approved as part of the union contract.
So the guild says.
Yes. And SPOG is really one of the more reactionary forces in Seattle politics. SPOG had rejected at the end of the year the tentative contract that agreement that had been reached with the city. And so as we move into 2016, we're going to have to look once again at what the police are going to be willing to sign off on, and whether the city will be will hold fast to try and get some of these reforms through that are being mandated by the federal court that is overseeing SPD at this point, and which also has to sign off on a new contract agreement.
Yeah. Okay. And there were some, as Jav was saying, talking about this a little bit before, there were some notable successes, small successes in the city of Seattle. In particular, in November, voters passed I-122, the public financing campaign. That'll be a good thing. And, of course, we had our very first and very successful elections for the new city council districts, where money played a big, big role, but didn't always mean that the best financed candidate won. For example, Lisa Herbold had about half the funding of her competitor, and she won in District 1. Also, the city council moved forward to ban youth detention in the city of Seattle, which means that they acknowledged that jail equals fail for kids, in at least in our city. The council also approved a $25 tax on the sale of firearms and a few penny tax on each cartridge of ammunition that's sold in the city of Seattle. That's that's being challenged currently in court, but we'll see if the city can argue that it really is a tax and not gun control laws, then that will stay in place. The council Also this year, two new homeless encampments opened, one in Interbay and one in Ballard. So something is going forward in terms of housing for the homeless, even if it's only temporary housing.
And that Ballard encampment got significant pushback from the local neighborhood. It's been continued to be a problem in terms of harassment from local residents.
Yeah, so we'll see if that can keep operating. And finally, the UW Regents voted to divest the UW's investment portfolio of stocks in coal companies under months of pressure by students, staff, and faculty. And in that process, the UW became the largest university to divest itself from coal.
Meantime,
so some good things happened this year.
Some good things. One other thing on local elections before we move on, which is that even though we'll have a more progressive majority in city council in 2016, and even though the districts were very successful, we also saw an unprecedented infusion of outside soft corporate money into the election process, backing establishment candidates, backing what was effectively a slate that was run by Mayor Murray and his campaign consultant, Christian Sinderman. Those forces are not going to go away in 2017 and future elections. And so seeing what the balance is going to be between new public financing that I-122 creates and the enormous amount of wealth that's coming into Seattle and outside corporations that have a lot of vested interest in a more conservative council majority, that back and forth is going to continue to dominate local political stories in years to come.
Yeah, and as we've seen with the $15 an hour minimum wage law that passed here in Seattle, things that are passed by the Seattle City Council can make a big splash around the country. So a lot of corporations, even ones that don't have headquarters here or don't have outlets here, or you would think don't have an interest in Seattle politics, definitely do now.
Yeah, and again, the Uber Lyft legislation that we talked about at the beginning
of
the show is another of those examples. Yes.
Yeah. There were some things that happened at the state level, too. There were some notable court decisions. The U.S. District Court dismissed a lawsuit against Seattle's $15 an hour minimum wage brought by the International Franchise Association. That was some good news there. Another court ruling extended SeaTac's $15 per hour minimum wage. That was the first $15 an hour minimum wage passed in the United States. They extended that to workers at SeaTac Airport, which, of course, is the largest employer in the city of SeaTac. So that was another big victory. The state Supreme Court had a couple of decisions this year, too. They ruled that charter schools are not common schools run by elected boards. Because charter schools have appointed boards, they do not qualify to receive public funding under the state constitution, and that decision was upheld later in the year. The state Supreme Court also started to levy a $100,000 per day fine on the state legislature for not adequately funding K-12 education during this past year's legislative session under the court's McCleary ruling. So the legislature remains in contempt of court. The fines are mounting, and that leads right into my second statewide topic, which is fighting over the state budget. The state legislature didn't finish drafting the budget for the current biennium until July, after two special sessions, and right as the fiscal year was ending on June 30th, they finally passed a budget. In November, state voters passed Tim Eymann's I-1366, which is going to lead to even bigger budget battles this coming year.
Unconstitutional.
Yeah.
That'll be challenged in court. It's being challenged in court.
We'll see. I mean, the last time Tim Eymann passed an initiative that affected state revenues, the Republicans got behind the ball and pushed it through. So we'll see what happens this year if Republicans seize on I-1366 and use it to really start all the budget process.
Yeah, and one more local story very quickly. We talked about the elections, but it's worth mentioning also that Seattle School Board has a new progressive majority, and that may portend good things for how the school district is run in the future as well. So that was exciting, positive news in 2015.
Yeah, and then the last story that I have is the state failing once again to really make any gains on limiting carbon emissions. Governor Inslee signed an agreement to steeply cut the state's carbon emissions, but the legislature refused to vote on it. And then they went on and ignored his proposal for a cap and trade system in the state budget. And then they passed a transportation bill that spends only 6% of its total funds on transit, bikes, and pedestrians, when transportation is the biggest industry to emit carbon emissions in the state of Washington. Washington currently is the only state that has signed on to the Western Climate Initiative that has done literally nothing to limit its emissions. That has to change this coming year.
Yeah, and that budget also has a poison pill for actually doing anything about climate change in the transportation budget.
In the transportation arena, yeah.
All right. Any events for this week?
Not this week. People are going and enjoying the holidays and having their Christmas parties, so go and have fun.
All right.
Yeah.